I'd like you to turn in your Bibles with us to John, the 18th chapter. We'll read the first 27 verses. Just trust that God will speak to our hearts as we study through his word. It says, when he had finished praying, Jesus left his disciples, left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding the detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches and lanterns and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who do you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." "I told you I am he," Jesus answered. "If you are looking for me, let these men go." This happened so that the words might be this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. "I have not lost one of those that you gave me. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his ear, his right ear. The servant was named Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink of the cup that the Father has given me?" Then a detachment of soldiers with its commander and Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest, that year. Caiaphas was one who had advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for the people. Simon Peter, another disciple, were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back and spoke to the girl on duty there and brought Peter in. "You are not one of the disciples, are you?" The girl at the door asked Peter. He replied, "I am not." It was cold, and the servants of the officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teachings. "As spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied, "I always taught in the synagogues or at the temple where the Jews are all come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" he demanded. "If I said something wrong," Jesus replied, "testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?" Then Annas sent him still bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. As Simon Peter stood warming himself, he was asked, "Are not you one of his disciples?" He denied it, saying, "I am not." One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him, "Didn't I see you with him in the olive grove?" Again, Peter denied it, And at that moment, the rooster began to crow. We'll go back and try to look at these verses quickly. The first verse says, when he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley on the other side of the where the garden, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. As you know, this immediately follows the sharing of Jesus with his disciples at the Passover meal. He had instructed them that concerning his what was about to transpire concerning his death and resurrection, and that he would send the Holy Spirit in his place, who would be with them to counsel them and guide them. He had just prayed that they be kept safely from the influences of this world, and that they would love one another and experience the unity that he and the Father experienced. All of this took place in a matter of an hour or two, but it is, we have been looking at it for some time now, and we've only scratched the surface of what he taught. The Kidron Valley again lay between Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives. There was a brook that run down that valley, and it was a summer, what they would call a wadi, dry up in the summertime, and they could easily pass on foot. In the garden, Jesus had visited with his disciples many times, was called Gethsemane, which means olive press. Probably the garden was a setting place for guests to enjoy as they came to observe the pressing of the olives, which was a time of celebration with the Jews. Jesus found it a convenient place to be alone with his disciples. Verse 2, now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often come there with his disciples. So it was his privilege as a disciple to know the favorite places of his master and to share in their private times together. But somewhere along the way, the aspirations of Judas parted ways with the intentions of Jesus, and bitterness seeped into his heart. But somewhere along the way, he had completely turned his heart away from the Lord. I don't think he was ever really a true disciple, because self-denial was a part of the call of Jesus. If any man will come after me, let him take up his cross and follow me. And Judas was in the game for himself, as was witnessed by his pilfering from the alms that were given to the poor. And that's recorded in John 12:6. Many civil servants and politicians begin with the aspirations of serving the people, but are waylaid by their own ambitions and desires. Jesus taught us to pray in that great prayer that he gave us, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And it's a good prayer to pray every day of your life. Dear God, keep me from temptation. Deliver me from evil. This apparently wasn't the prayer of Judas. Verse 3, so Judas came to the garden, guiding the detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches and lanterns and weapons. It reminds me of one of the last scene in the film, the movie about Frankenstein. They're coming out after a dangerous and terrifying enemy. Judas had sold his soul to the enemies of Jesus, and he was leading the lynch mob to find him. A mob is a horde of cowards who have no values of their own and would never dare to act by themselves. That, I think, applies to every crowd or every mob that I have ever heard about or ever seen. Verse 4, Jesus, knowing all of this was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, who is it that you want? So Jesus has stepped forward to face this mob entirely alone and by himself. He went out knowing all that was going to happen to him, it says in the fourth verse. That means that he turned himself over to the malicious intent of this out-of-control mob. He stepped up to face them with nothing more than you or I have ourselves. That is the promise of a resurrection. Would you step in front of a mob like that so quickly with nothing more than the promise of a resurrection? Jesus didn't look forward to a deliverance. He wasn't looking for the angels to take his back. He wasn't looking for God to intervene. He knew all that was going to happen. So he steps forward with only one thing to shelter him, and that's the knowledge of the resurrection. Well, you and I both have that same promise, and we ought to be as courageous as he is. But we'll look a little further to see where he got his courage. Verse 5 and 6, he asked them, what do you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. I am he, Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there. Judas may have already greeted him with his poisonous token of affection that we read about in Luke, the 22nd chapter. Jesus acknowledged the hypocrisy when he asked, Judas, are you betraying your master with a kiss? Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? What an awkward moment it must have been for Judas while he stood there waiting for this crowd, this mob, to seize Jesus. In fact, when Jesus said, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. These are armed guards who have come with a mob to arrest Jesus, and they are collapsing like rag dolls in his presence. Perhaps God was making the statement to this crowd as to who, in fact, was in charge. It reminds me of the 50 soldiers that Ahab sent to seize Elijah. Fire fell from the sky and consumed them all. And the same thing happened to the 50 who replaced them. And it would have happened to the next 50 if he had not begged Elijah to have mercy on him. God is certainly in charge under all circumstances. And these soldiers that came out so violently to arrest Jesus were getting a small example of God's power. Verse 7 and 8, he asked him again, who do you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they said. Jesus answered, I told you, I am he. If you are looking for me, let these men go. This explains, I think, why Jesus used his authority to intimidate them. It was to protect his disciples. Verse 9, this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those that you gave me. You can read those words in John 6:39. And again in John 17:12, Jesus said it twice. He said, he said that he would not lose any of those that God had given him. So Jesus was willing to be swept into a flood of hatred and rage, but not until his disciples were safe. Verse 10, then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Peter's love for Jesus caused him to strike out against impossible odds. I'm confident that most of us would face an angry mob to rescue someone that we loved if they were being attacked. The instincts of a parent is to put themselves between whatever danger may approach their children, no matter how overwhelming the odds. So I think this is an act of instinct, the instinct of love that Peter had towards Jesus. Peter is an interesting study in courage. In the heat of the moment, no one ever knows how they might react. Some men spring to heroic action that they never even realized was within them. Others are paralyzed with fear and shrivel away in shame. Peter had determined within himself that he would never let Jesus down. He confessed his willingness to lay down his life for Jesus in John 12:37. Jesus rebuked him for his self-confidence in verse 38. Will you really lay down your life for me? Verily, I tell you the truth, before the rooster crows this very morning, you will disown me three times. How incredible a prophecy is that? Here is a man that is full of determination to stand for the Lord and feels that he is willing to die for him. And he shows that when the mob shows up. He's willing to fight and to die for Jesus. But courage isn't always that uncomplicated, is it? On the other hand, Jesus gave Peter the opportunity. He says, you're going to deny me. Then he gave Peter the opportunity in the garden to fortify his commitment to him by supporting him in prayer as Jesus was fortifying himself to do the will of God. You remember the story, right? That they were in, Jesus went away to pray. He brought three of his closest disciples, asked them to pray with him, and they fell asleep. He came back and pleaded with them to stay awake, and they fell asleep three times. Peter's self-confidence made his need for spiritual fortification seem less acute. Have you ever been in that situation where you feel so confident that you don't really feel that prayer is essential or necessary? So he couldn't stay awake, and he fell asleep. When the crisis arrived, Peter reacted out of his own human reserves, which were out of sync with the will of God. He was ready to fight to the death, but he got another rebuke from the master. You're not doing what God intends to be done. You're fighting against the will of God. Put away your sword. Don't you know that I have to do what God has called me to do? So Peter was rebuked. This is exactly why Jesus had been praying so desperately in the garden while Peter was sleeping. He was aligning himself with the will of God. That's what we have to do as Christians, continually align ourselves with the will of God. We can't go off and just live as though God didn't even have a will for us. But we should constantly be seeking to understand what God's will is for our life. Well, Peter was so confident he fell asleep while Jesus was praying desperately in the garden. asking God, and he said, "This isn't my will, God. Nevertheless, thy will be done." And in the course of that prayer, he came into alignment with the will of God. The last thing he prayed, "Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." Jesus commanded Peter, "Put up your sword. Shall I not drink of what the Father has given me?" Then a detachment of soldiers with its commander and Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him. They brought him first to Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. Annas was the high priest who was recognized by the Jewish people. He came out of the Hasmonean or the Maccabean contingent. And Rome was suspicious of their continual zealot behavior, constantly contending against Romans, and so they took the high priestship away from Annas and gave it to his son-in-law, Caiaphas. He was appointed by the Roman authorities, so that's why you have these two priests. And the Jews take them first to their high priest, and then they take them to the high priest that is appointed by the Romans. Caiaphas had been the one who had said, "We've got to kill Jesus, or the Romans are going to destroy the Jews." I don't know why he felt that way. I don't think Jesus really mattered that much at that point to the Romans. It was the Jews that drove the wedge between Jesus and the Romans by saying that he calls himself a king. Jesus never openly called himself a king, but they used that to threaten Pilate in order to have Jesus executed. After being reproved by Jesus for striking the high priest's servant, Peter and John, who rarely calls himself by name in the Gospels, he always calls himself the apostle or the other apostle, but it is most certainly John. They followed along at a discreet distance, or at least in a discreet manner. I'd like to point out here that secret discipleship rarely works because it's a self-contradiction. You can't be a secret disciple and go into the world and preach the gospel. Those two things are antithetical, aren't they? We're secret about our relationship with Jesus, and yet we're telling his wonderful gospel? I don't think so. And all of those who tried it, Nicodemus being another one, who tried to be a secret disciple of Jesus, came to places where they regretted that they had not been open and honest about their receiving Christ as their Lord. Verse 15 and 16, Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Peter and John were following Jesus because this disciple was known by the high priest. He went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside the door. He didn't have an invitation. John must have known Annas before he became a disciple. Maybe Annas even knew his family. I doubt Annas knew that John had become a disciple of Jesus because he's allowing him to move freely in the courtyards. So John uses his freedom to get Peter into the courtyard. The other disciple, who is John, was known to the high priest. He came back, spoke to the servant girl who was on duty, and brought Peter in. Verse 17, "You aren't one of the men, one of those, you are not this man's disciple also, are you?" she asked him. He replied, "I am not." She may have been among the mob that had arrested Jesus. If so, the pre-dawn darkness and confusion must have made it difficult for her to identify Peter positively. You might have noticed, as I have, that women are playing an active role in the riots that are scattered across our nation today. They played a predominant role in the bloody French Revolution. Also, women can be just as malicious in riots and that kind of activity as men. Riots are not about truth, they're not about justice, they're about a self-righteous hatred. If you look at the riots that we're seeing across the land, that's exactly what they're based on, a self-righteous hatred. Peter, no doubt, was surprised by the girl's question. He didn't intend to deny Jesus. It was an attempt to remain discreetly close to Jesus. But it was a denial nevertheless. Jesus had told Peter he would deny him three times before the cock crowed. This was the first. Every adversary loves a surprise attack. And I think we ought to notice this about Peter. First, he is courageous. Then he's trying to be discreet. Then he is surprised by this accusation. Every enemy loves a surprise attack. They catch us off balance and unprepared. Washington's only advantage against the British on Christmas Eve in 1776 was surprise. He was outmanned, he was outgunned, he had nothing but the element of surprise. Satan is a master at attacking us when we least expect it. So that's something that we can learn about courage. You can be very courageous when you're on your mark, but sometimes when you're not paying attention, sometimes when you're not ready, you get blindsided. Satan is good about that. So we need to remember that. Verse 18. It was cold, and the servants' officials stood around the fire that they had made to keep warm. Peter was also standing with them, warming himself. Satan was setting Peter up for his second denial. No one likes standing out in the cold all by themselves while everyone else is being warmed by one another's companionship. I can't think of an analogy that speaks better to the allurement of this world to Christians. Peter knew these were enemies of his Lord, but he was drawn to their fire, which was irresistible that cold morning. His consolation was that he was only sharing physically with them, not spiritually. That's what he would be telling himself. It's a cold morning, and I'm not among these people. I'm not with them. I'm not of them. I'm just taking this opportunity to warm myself at their fire. Jesus had warned him in the garden that he needed to fortify himself through prayer. Again, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And Peter is being drawn like a moth to this open flame. Verse 19 and through 24, meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his discipleship and his teachings. So while Peter was warming himself at the fire of the enemy, Jesus was facing an inquisition. He said, "I have spoken openly in the world. I have always taught in the synagogues, in the temple, where all of the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why ask me? Ask those who heard me. I've been speaking publicly. Ask the public. Surely they know what I said. Of course, their purpose was to try to trap Jesus into some statement either against the law of Moses or Roman law. Since they had nothing to charge him with, they have gone out with this huge mob, they have arrested him, and nobody has stopped to think about what are we going to charge him with. Here they have him under arrest, they have him brought before the court. They have nothing to charge him with. Jesus suggested that they might want to gather their evidence first before they had arrested him. Can you imagine being arrested and subjected to an attempt to discover the cause of your arrest? Doesn't that sound funny? Here you are arrested, here we are in court, and we're here to find out why we arrested you. That's what's taking place. Jesus says if you wanted charges, go out and look for them because there's a lot of information out there about me. I did nothing in secret. When Jesus said this, one of the high officials slapped him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest, he demanded? If I were Jesus, I would have said, yes, it is. Instead, he said, if I've said something wrong, testify to what it is. And if I haven't, then why have you struck me? It's not disrespectful to ask that charges be brought before you're put on trial. The official struck him simply out of his own biased hatred and probably doesn't even have a good reason why. It's just a matter of being a part of the mob. You don't have to have reasons. You're just swept up into the emotion of hatred. Verse 25, meanwhile, Peter was still standing there warming himself. So they asked him, aren't you one of the disciples too? And he denied it and said, I am not. What's going on here? Has Peter really changed his mind about Jesus or not? I don't think so. It's just every time you deny anything, it makes it that much harder to own up to the truth the next time. Peter has already verbally denied Jesus once, and he's continued to affirm that denial by his silence as he is there warming himself with the enemies of Jesus. How could he say, yes, I am a disciple, without looking like the biggest fool and the greatest lying coward on the planet? So face-saving is another tool of the enemy that he uses against us. He loves to attack us when we're not ready, and he loves to use our own ego and pride against us. Hey, Peter couldn't say, yes, I am a disciple, and I wasn't telling the truth a little while ago, and I am willing to face anything for Jesus, for he is my master. He couldn't say that and save face at the same time. If you live for Jesus, you won't be able to save face in the world. Let me just tell you that. Let me help all of us to recognize this point. You can't save face in the world if you intend to be a Christian. If they don't insult you to your face, they will insult you behind your back. It's why Jesus said, if the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. He said over and over, didn't he? And as we were reading the approach to these scriptures, that the world hates his disciples. They hate him. So we're going to have to own up to being a Jesus and to be laughed at or to be ridiculed or to be hated if we're going to be a Christian. And if we keep trying to put that off, it's just going to make it harder. The more entrenched we are in our silence, the more entrenching silence becomes. It becomes more and more and more embarrassing to finally admit, after all these months, after all these years, after a lifetime, that I am truly a Christian. The longer I go, the harder it gets. So don't try to save face in the world. Don't try to look good in their eyes. Verse 26, one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him. Didn't I see you in the garden with him? This is the third challenge. Now Peter panics. This man is ready to turn the wolves loose on him. He is so terrified, he denounces Jesus with curses and oaths, according to Mark, the 14th chapter, 71st verse. He not only denounced Jesus, he said, "May God destroy me if I am one of his disciples." That's a that's what you would call a curse. He called a curse down on his own head if he knows Jesus. That's real panic, isn't it? And he also oaths, "I swear." Swear by what? What do you want me to swear? "I swear I don't know this man." What a difference this is from Peter, who had told Jesus that, "I would die with you, though no one else would. I would die for you, Jesus." And here he is swearing before God that he doesn't know Jesus. And you see how he got there, right? Little by little. First by being blindsided while he was trying to be discreet in his following of Jesus. Then by trying to save face before these people he has denied already. Now he is in a panic situation. He has surrendered all of his courage. He is not ready to be accused again. And he denies Jesus in the most radical way anybody could. And think of this. Jesus said, "If you deny me before men, what's he going to do? Deny you before his Father in heaven." This is a serious thing. Peter has done it three times, denied Jesus three times. When he denies him this last time, according to Luke, the 22nd chapter, 60 through 62, Jesus looked up, turned, and looked at Peter. Wow, how would you feel? And when Peter made the last denial, he heard the cock crow. Everything came back. That moment, Peter went out, according to Luke 22:60 through 62, and wept bitterly. Jesus turned, looked at him. Peter realized what he had just done. He broke down in tears. I don't know what he left those people there at the fire. If he pushed his way through the gate, he went out weeping bitterly, whatever that means. If he's bawling at the top of his voice, or if he's weeping inwardly, but he's not saving face. He doesn't look that good. Doesn't look like they were even interested in chasing him down. Later, many years after this, Peter warned us all, "Be alert. Be sober-minded." When? Now. But there's nothing to fear now. There's more to fear than you know. Every day of your life, Peter would say, "Be alert and be sober of mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Listen to me, it almost happened to me. I know what I'm talking about. That's 1 Peter 5 and 8. Sounds something like the advice that Peter gave, or that Jesus gave to Peter. Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. How many of you want to follow the Lord? How many want you to continue to follow the Lord all the days of your life? Every one of us would. You've got to be alert, because the devil is going to do everything he can to see that you don't. And when you feel the most secure is when you're most vulnerable to attack. He will blindside you while you are in your self-confidence. And you will find yourself without thinking you ever would. I can't imagine denying Jesus. Well, I would have. Because Peter was a stronger man of character than I am. So if that's true, I'm going to do everything I can do to fortify myself every single day, whether it is full of challenges or if it's just a day I'm going to have a nice picnic out somewhere in the woods. I am going to fortify myself. I'm going to ask God, lead me not into temptation, but deliver me from the evil one today. As bright and glorious as this day is, today, Lord, deliver me from temptation. And if we will pray that way, we'll have a lot better chance of standing up against that roaring lion who's ready to pounce when you least expect. Amen. Well, I've been told that many times. It has made an impression on me to a degree, but never to the degree that it needs to. This is one more time you're being told. May we all listen as earnestly as we can to the warning of a man who only by the grace of God wasn't completely devoured by the enemy. Amen. God bless you. Let's spend a few moments in prayer, please.